Please turn off your beepers and cell phones and do not bring any beverages or food into the church. Refreshments must remain in the Duke Room. My name is Dory, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Dustina and Kobe, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Lewis will read the preamble.
My name is Luis and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Marlena B. will read the steps.
I'm Marlena, an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to participate in the meeting tonight. I had my last drink of alcohol 40 years ago tonight, and it's a pleasure. The 12 steps. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Number four, made a searching, fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Number seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Number nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Number 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Thank you.
Frank C. will read the traditions.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Frank Cordovano. Hi, everyone. The 12 traditions. Number one, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, but they do govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, prosperity, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supportive, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never to be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never to be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. And 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Travis.
Whoo!
Hey, I'm Travis, alcoholic.
That's the longest reading of the traditions ever. I'm going to start with my stats. This is my home group, the Atlantic Group. My sponsor's name is David Kay. I'm currently living very happy in 10, 11, and 12. Reworking the steps on my fifth step. And the last drink that I had was December 7th of 2004. And I'm actually going to go back about a year almost to the day before my last drink. I was sitting in jail one night. That came out a little bit more nonchalant than it probably should have. I'd gotten a DUI. It was December 2003. It was in Middletown, New Jersey. And I was stuck in this little cell. I had no one to call. Sitting on a little wooden bench. And it was probably one of the first times that I remember, like, walking through my story to myself. And I was just sitting there thinking, like, what happened? You know, I was coming home from work. And I got nabbed right outside of my house. Initially I was angry. I was angry at the cops. Like, how dare you? I've been so much drunker when I drove before. I was up all night and I just sat there and I thought, like, what happened? You know, I can remember 8, 9 years earlier when I first moved out. I was 18 years old. First of any of my friends to have my own place. I had a little 2-bedroom house. With a backyard, and I had a keg on tap, like, within 6 months of living there, and it was just, like, everything was a party, everything was fun, and, you know, I'm not gonna go into the stories, but I could just tell you all the stories were funny, and they were crazy, and they were, you know, ridiculous, insane stuff that we did, and, you know, as I was sitting there thinking about it, you know, I realized that the stories stopped becoming fun. They started becoming, like, a little bit more sad, a little bit more embarrassing, you know? And then, you know, towards the end, they were just pathetic. In a very, what I considered a very short period of time, and I suffered with this I'm too young thing till the first, you know, my first 6 months in here. But, you know, and I thought about the last, like, couple months leading up to this DUI, how I would go out and drink with my friends after work, and I could not just have two. And every time I went out, it was the same conversation. I would sit there and I would say, you know, guys, I don't want to go out. You know, I got to work tomorrow. And they'd be like, come on, just come out for a few. I'd be like, okay, I'll have two. And then they'd make fun of me. They'd be like, yeah, okay, just two, Travis. You know, I would wake up either at home. I'd wake up on one of my friend's couches. Or, you know, I'd wake up somewhere I didn't know where I was. I didn't understand what happened to my drinking. And, you know, that night, I did a lot of soul searching. And I decided that I was never going to drink again. I'd made this decision before, you know, a dozen times at least. But this time it was for real. And within 2 weeks, I drove home in a blackout. And at that point, I pretty much knew that alcohol won, Travis zero. And I gave up to the idea of quitting drinking at that point. My new solution was, I was living in Jersey at the time, my new solution was I was going to lose my car anyway. I was going to lose my license anyway. Sell my car and move to Manhattan, then I wouldn't have to worry about it. And so I started to make those plans. And for the next 6 months, my drinking went from just kind of sad and sort of, you know, lame to completely pathetic, alone, isolated. You know, I was afraid to go out. I was afraid of what was going to happen. I was tired of blacking out, which I did at this point every time I drank. I was tired of, you know, having to look at my online Wachovia account to see where I was, like where did I charge my credit cards. And I just thought I would just, you know, have just as much fun at home alone. And over those next 6 months, I mean, I went out a few times, but not much. I was actually content with that decision, as sad as that sounds, you know. And it wasn't me, like I had no problem hurting me. I had no problem hurting most of the people around me. I just didn't really care at that point. But it actually wasn't until I hurt somebody who I cared about more than myself. This is hard. My sister, and she's actually here tonight. You know, I prayed before and I said, if I cry, I might curse God. So try not to make me cry. I was at my sister's house, I was at a party, and I just woke up with that feeling of, I know I did something screwed up, I didn't know what it was, and I came out and I saw the look on her face, and that was all I needed, you know. And at that point, you know, after a long discussion about what I had done, I decided that was it. I was really done at that point. And for the next 6 months, at this point I knew nothing of you people, for the next 6 months I was dry. And I was miserable, I was more isolated, I wasn't getting to sleep as early because I didn't pass out as much, so I just had a lot of time in my head by myself, and I went insane. Now, over that time, I started to open up to people a little bit more and start to talk to them about this, and somebody had recommended, they were like, you know, maybe you want to talk to somebody at AA, and my initial reaction was, you know, I haven't had a drink in 3 months, like, that's not my problem. But eventually I decided, yeah, I'll try it out. It'll be interesting conversation. And I got introduced to somebody, and we sat in a diner, and he did something no one ever did. I was used to my sister, my mother, my friends, my girlfriends, all sitting there talking to me about my drinking, you know? This guy didn't say a word about my drinking. He didn't ask me a question. He told me about his. And that blew my mind. And what blew my mind even more was he told my story right up to that age, and then he told me the next 15 years of what I could look into. He also explained to me something that I just never understood. I thought I had low self-control. I never understood why I just couldn't have two drinks. And he explained to me that this is a disease, you know, this is a physical allergy, that if you're an alcoholic, you have it. You can't just have two. And it kind of made sense. I was still a little skeptical, and, you know, we bounced around for a while. Eventually, he handed me a piece of paper one day with a name on it and a phone number. And, you know, this is pretty common for most of us that have been around for a while. We call people we don't know all the time. But before, I was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to call this guy. And he was like, no, I really think you should call this dude. I don't know. I do know what it was. It was not me. It was God. That one day I was sitting in my office, and I was just in a lot of pain. And I walked in the corner, and I called this guy, and we started talking. And he was dry for a while before he came into the program, too. And we talked for a while. He met me for lunch, like, several times. I would call him up at, like, 11:15. You want to meet for lunch? And just so I could argue with him why I'm not an alcoholic. And he showed up every time. He brought me here to my first meeting, which scared me completely. I don't remember what anybody said. I don't remember who spoke. All I remember was walking around to thank the speakers, and I saw the steps, and I took issue with 11 and a half of them. I saw the God stuff, and that was it. I was like, that's cool, that's all. But at this point, I had like 6 months dry. I have this thing pretty much pegged, maybe a little therapy. A few weeks after I made the decision to say Alcoholics Anonymous was not for me, I was in an airport in Dallas. arguing with some girl I was seeing at the time. I hung up the phone, and without even thinking twice, I got a drink. And I got obliterated. I blacked out. I woke up the next morning and at home in my bed to my best friend calling me up saying, dude, what happened? I called him on the way back from the airport or something. And I knew I was done. And I came back here. And the one thing I did get out of this meeting was I heard everybody talk about sponsor. I had no idea what the heck a sponsor was or what the steps were or half this AA lingo. But it sounded like everybody liked the sponsor guys. So I came in here and I said, I don't know what it is, but I want one. And I was introduced to my sponsor. We went to a diner right down the street. He was totally not who I would have picked. You know, he's a little older, he's married. I wouldn't have drank with him, you know, I'll say that. And first thing he said to me was, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I was like, yeah, you know. And he's like, are you willing to go to any lengths? He asked me twice. He looked in my eyes. And the second time, I'm like, okay, what is he going to come at me with? I said yes. I was beaten at that point. I had the gift of desperation. And, you know, then he proceeded to ramble off this ridiculous list of all these things I had to do in order for him to work with me. And they were not suggestions at that time. There was a lot of them. He talked about gratitude lists, stuff like that. But the only one I took issue with was prayer. And I think this is such a great analogy to how this program works. I told him, I'm like, there's no way I'm praying. There's no way I got God issues, forget about it. And we compromised that you're going to get on your knees and talk to yourself. And that's what I did. Initially it was, this is retarded, what am I doing, blah, blah, blah. And eventually it was, okay, I know you're not listening, but... And it turned into what it is today. I pray all the time. I just hid back there and prayed for 10 minutes. And, prayed not to cry, not to curse. got 50% of that prayer taken care of. That's all my time. But, I mean, just in, real quickly, that's how this program works. You know, I don't need to understand. I don't need to agree with it. I just do it. In hindsight, everything has worked for me. If you're new, grab a sponsor. And they will, you know, at the end of the meeting, everyone's going to raise their hand, say they're an Atlantic Group member. Just grab one of them and just listen to what they say. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Danielle.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Danielle. I'm an alcoholic. Hi. I'm very nervous, just so you know. I just found out today that I would be speaking, so... Okay. The stats, just like you did. I'm an alcoholic. Liz S. is my sponsor. I am working on step one. AG is my home group. October 3rd, 2005 is my sober date. Okay, where to begin? I can remember from the age of 6 years old, that was probably my my earliest memory of me loving alcohol. When I was younger, I grew up in Europe. My family, no one is an alcoholic. But when we grew up in Europe, sorry, I'm nervous. When we grew up in Europe, we used to have dinner parties, and there was always alcohol around. And from not being in an alcohol, from everyone, my entire family, I always perceived them to be just incredibly, like, leave it to beaver, perfect, and I always felt like I was on the outside. I always, from my earliest memory, felt incredibly different. And my earliest memory is of being 6 years old. And growing up in Europe, I remember my family had dinner parties, and they would. It was very normal for them to pass around alcohol and to just give, you know, their kids a sip of wine at the dinner table. And I remember from that day on just always being like, I want to do what the grown-ups do. I want to drink when I get older. And skipping ahead to when I had my first drink, which was somewhere around the age of 11 or 12 years old. That was when I had my first drink. My first drink, it was I blacked out from the moment I first started drinking. I don't remember my first drink, but on one of my, I started drinking alcoholically right from the beginning. I was a blackout drinker. I acted very erratic right from the beginning, and the first people who were around me to witness my behavior when I was drinking were my family. And I just remember vividly my brother being so scared and being like, what is going on with you? Why are you acting so crazy? And just me throwing up everywhere and being belligerent and crying. You know, once again, I had always felt incredibly different. I was very dishonest. I was very, I was a big isolator. And I remember Joan Morgan has always said that it was very easy for her to make friends, but it was hard for her to keep friends, and I really identify with that. It was very easy for me to make friends, but it was very hard for me to keep friends. So, you know, I wasn't a daily drinker at that point, and I was, throughout high school, you know, every once in a while I would, you know, when times would get too tough, I would fill up the sports bottle with vodka here and there and drink it and bring it to class. It was very hard for me to get through high school. And a lot of times I would just not go to class. And I just blamed my problems on a lot of other people and on circumstances outside of myself. I felt very lost. When I graduated high school, I was excited. I wanted to leave New York. I blamed all my problems on New York. So I was like, I'm going to move out to LA. I'm going to become an actress. You know, I'm going to, you know, make it in Hollywood. And I moved out to LA and I got accepted to a really good acting school. And as soon as I started going to that school, the only thing I knew how to do when socializing with people was to drink and, of course, pick up other substances along the way. And, you know, I really believe that I went there with some really good talent, but unfortunately, that was just numbed with all of the drinking and other stuff that I did. And as a result of that and my unmanageability, I wasn't accepted back the next year, but that didn't prevent me from staying out there. I stayed out there, and I ended up picking up another addiction. And the only reason why I mention this is because while I was doing that other substance, I was convinced that I wasn't an alcoholic. In the back of my mind, I always believed that I had a drinking problem. People, my parents, you know, like I had mentioned earlier, my family witnessed that I had problems with drinking from a very young age. And so while I was doing that, I didn't think I had a drinking problem. That got out of control. So I came back to New York. I thought that would solve my problem, but it didn't. I went right back to drinking heavily, round the clock. And, you know, that's when I became a full-blown alcoholic, I believe. And, you know, with that, once I became a full-blown alcoholic, I picked up very destructive behaviors. I was stealing from cars, you know, I was drinking and driving, and when I moved to the city, I was blacking out every single day when I was drinking and ending up in different parts of the city. I wanted to move to my recovery, so basically what happened was that I really couldn't go on much longer than that. My bottom is pretty awful, but I don't want to really get into it. It's just that, like on any other normal day, it was nothing unusual about that day. I was drinking, and I drank very heavily, and I ended up on the opposite side of the city out of a blackout, and I could have put myself in a position where I was killed. And, you know, something inside of me woke up that day, and I know in my heart that it was for the grace of God. I know in my heart. And I called my mom the day after, and I was like, I'm dying, and you know, she had mentioned to me in the past that I needed to go to rehab. And I said to her, I need to go to rehab. I'm killing myself. I'm drinking every day, and I can't stop. And so I went to rehab. And, you know, since then, while I was in rehab, Pam from the Atlanta group came to visit, and she had mentioned how she went to this great group, the Atlanta group. And I was like, oh, that sounds great. You know, she sounded like, you know, she had everything together and this and that. And it really is attraction rather than promotion or whatever that saying is. And so I came out of rehab and I came to the Atlanta group and I was told to get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. I got a commitment. And I was told to start filling up my phone with phone numbers. And, you know, I'm a big isolator. And that taking those actions has really changed my personality. And just recently, I've really had this awakening to really see within myself a major change within my personality. I haven't realized it until just now. And, you know, I have 3 commitments. I'm sponsoring right now. And that's been one of the greatest gifts that I've had in my life. I've repaired my relationships with my parents, with friends in the past. I've got to go back to the liquor store that I stole from and make an amends, which is just huge. You know, I've had great teachers along the way. Yeah, I know, right? I've had great teachers along the way who have really guided me and helped me to learn how to live, because I really didn't know how to. I was like a little girl lost. And, you know, I just, I go to this really good meeting on Monday night, this meditation meeting, and the reason why I mention it is because I had such an issue with God for like the last year. And just recently I started praying every day and every night, and it's just really changed everything in my life, just my attitude. And, you know, it's I have to, like, be beat over the head constantly over and over again until I get it. And if you're new, just keep coming back, get a sponsor, get a commitment, do exactly what they tell you. And if you don't believe, just do it until you do. That's it. Thank you.
Our main speaker tonight is Eddie O.
Good evening, I'm Eddie, I'm an alcoholic. And it's great to be back at the Atlanta Group. I've been speaking for you guys a lot of times. Started up in the 90s in that little room and several times here. And the way you guys are growing, I may be in Yankee Stadium one of these days soon. But your growth is that you're doing something right. But before I tell you what it was like, what happened and what it's like today, I want to share with you. I'm sitting over there, and all of a sudden I become fixated on this bottle of water. And then I'm one of those alcoholics like many of us. I never want to be embarrassed. I want to be right. I want to look good, whether I was a drunk or sober. And the first thought occurs to me, you're going to have some water when you get up there. And then it comes. What if you can't open the bottle? All these people will be looking at you, and then AA kicks in and asks for help. I was going to hand the bottle to Peggy if I couldn't open it, so hang on. No, I can open it. But really, what my message in that little vignette is, ask for help. As you'll hear through my story, I was in and out for 6 years because I didn't ask for help. The help is here. If you go away for anything tonight, ask somebody for help. Or if you can't even ask, look like you need help. Anyway, it's great to be back at the Atlanta Group. There was a long time in my drinking. I was never asked back anywhere. In fact, the words I used to hear, and never come back, and never was underlined, and all in bold type, by employers, by a wife, by girlfriends, by saloon keepers. I was once thrown out of a joint around the corner from my house on York Avenue called the Penguin. The Penguin had people sleeping on the bars, in the booths. There were no penguins. And the owner of the joint says, "We don't want people like you in here." I was thrown off, well, they call it social services. I grew up, it was welfare. Welfare wouldn't handle me anymore because I didn't want to play the game their way. And now, basically, I'm welcome wherever I go. So, I'm a member of the 79th Street Workshop. I love this group, but the old saying, home is where the heart is. I got sober at the 79th Street Workshop, and hopefully they'll have to carry me out of there. But originally, I was born in the South Bronx 71 years ago to Irish immigrant parents. My mother didn't drink. My father had a fondness for the drink, as they'd say. I was at a meeting in Ireland. You know, the fondness turns. I remember a guy said in a meeting in Ireland, "And the bloody drink had me by the throat." And it did, yeah. But it was always the drink. AA was around. I was born in the South Bronx. Because of my father's fondness for the drink, we moved around a lot. Dad had all sorts of different jobs. We ended up in the 40s. And if you took Duke Ellington's A train to the end of the line, you'd be in a section called Inwood, which was an Irish-American ghetto with a smattering of other people, jam-packed with saloons like Ireland, and everybody drank. And it just seemed the way. You went to saloons to get jobs, and if you stayed too long, you lost the job. You went there to look for your car or your girlfriend or your child or whatever, but our lives revolved around a saloon. AA was out there. You heard about it a little, but the general feeling of AA was the following. It's an Irish wake. The grieving widow is up by the casket. An old friend of the deceased shows up and says, "Oh, Mary, I'm so sorry to hear about Tim. What happened?" And she says, "'Twas the drink that killed him, Tom. The drink, morning, noon, and night, the drink." And he says, "Did he ever think of AA?" And she says, "Jesus, man, he wasn't that bad." And none of us thought we were that bad. It was work, church, and a dry sandwich, and off you went. I started drinking at 13 years old. And I was 46 when I got here. The drinking in the beginning was fun. Everybody did it. There was a draft on, and then by the time I was 16, I had a phony draft card. The bartenders were all, "Do you have your card?" That's all. The card could have said you are a Martian. But, you know, "You have your card." "I have my card." "Okay, good." We summered in wonderful romantic places like Rockaway. Rockaway was wonderful. I remember I was the only child, so I was like an Irish prince, and my mother worried about me, and she said, "Now, where did you stay in Rockaway?" I said, "Oh, Mom, we were at the Underwood Hotel," which means we slept under the boardwalk. The old Underwood Hotel, drunk and asleep on the sand. I got my first tattoo in Rockaway. It was a rite of passage. It was my last tattoo, but I was with a guy by the name of Eddie G. We went into the tattoo parlor. After drinking, we only had a couple of bucks left. Says to the guy, "We want tattoos." He shows us the head of Christ. He shows us clipper ships. They're all 10. We said, "We got a $5 between us." He said, "Put your name on your arm in writing, in script writing." I mean, I was way ahead of monogram purses. So I had him put Ed O.H. on my arms. He's going to get some needle, great sterilized, a napkin and a rubber band. The blood's running down my arm. Eddie G. says, gets in the chair, he says, "Give me the same thing." So he put Ed O.H. on Ed G.'s arm. To this day, he's still got it. He's still alive out in California. We went in the Army. I stayed here in the East. He went to Japan. He came back. He looks like a walking art gallery. He's got things up and down every arm. I got out of the Army. I had gone to college. I had gone to high school. I wanted to be a writer. I got into advertising. When I got into advertising, I guess that's the first time I discovered that I was very uncomfortable without being with my own Irish Americans, drinkers, etc. And I started to feel that less than. I didn't have a label for it, but I was less than. I was in the mailroom of a large advertising agency, and I was with guys. The names were Fremont Nittle, Berters Cartwright Chambers III. And I said, where's the Muldoons and the Moriartys and everything? And these guys, they came from, one guy's father was the publisher of the Daily Mirror, that's how far it went. Another guy was part of the Otis Elevator Clan and everything. So I was still at home living with my mother and father, and I said to Mom, I'm embarrassed. We were supers. And she says, well, tell them we're in building management. And so, but I was blessed with some brains and the Irish gift to grab, and I got out of the mailroom, and I put together a sort of a career as an account executive who basically was a wine and dine guy for the agencies. And with it came the license to take people out to drink and drink with them as long as they wanted and then drink on your own on an expense account. And I blew through that for many years. But always, no matter what time it was of the night, I returned to the old neighborhood and set the bar up in whatever joint I was hanging out at the time. And then I would ask the bartender to give me money to go to work the next day, but I just had bought the bar around. All that kind of big shotism. But the drink was getting me. I think by the time I was 21 years old, 22, I needed a drink in the morning to get going. It was there. I moved up slowly but surely. By the time I was 30 years old, I got married. She was pregnant. I was brought up to do the code was the right thing. So the right thing probably would have been to get on a bus and go to Pittsburgh. But I got married. We had two children. One died in infancy. The other guy is sober today, which is a blessing. The marriage lasted maybe 5 years, and then she moved on. And that really even opened up the drinking more. I started to lose jobs in advertising. For a while, I'd say the chemistry wasn't right here. Yeah, the chemistry was in a bottle. But after a while, I guess I was working at an agency, and I did a presentation, and I was drunk, and I knocked over charts and everything. So I was fired. And as I was getting my mustering out pay out of this agency, the lady said, you know, Eddie, my brother has the same problem as you do. And I said, what problem is that? Is he out of work? And she said, no. He's an alcoholic. Now, I had heard of alcoholism. You know, I didn't know where it was or what. You know, in fact, alcohol, you know, people talk about genetically disposed to alcohol or environmentally influenced. I like to talk about alcoholism in terms of grits. I was one time in Tupelo, Mississippi. I wanted to see where the king lived. And I went to, early in the morning, a little diner, and Yam of the Era, where the king was king. I sat down and I ordered bacon and eggs. And when they came, there was this white stuff on the corner. And I called the waitress over and I said, what's this? And she said, them's grits, honey. And I said, grits? I didn't order grits. And she said, you don't order grits, honey. They just come. And that was... That's as far as I want to trace my alcoholism. It just come, man. It's like my grits. So anyway, there I was like her brother. I got alcoholism. She said. So I said, well, what did your brother do for his alcoholism? And she said he went to AA. And I said, oh, yeah, I remember AA. We had a bartender in the neighborhood. You'd walk in and say, I haven't seen Peggy. I haven't seen Ron or something. And he'd conspiratorially ask you to lean over and he'd say, the body snatchers got him. That means they went to AA, and you know, I take. So off I go to join the Body Snatchers. I called Intergroup. I found where a meeting was. And I'll never forget my first meeting. It was in a church on 231st Street, off Broadway, Kingsbridge Avenue. A little park across the street. Now, I was the kind of guy, I'd walk into saloons in Harlem wearing a Ku Klux Klan sheet. I didn't care, you know? And I'm hiding behind a tree watching the people go into this meeting. I mean, really and truly. Anyway, I went. And there was Peggy, and there was Ron, and all the guys, the Body Snatcher God. And I loved it from my first meeting. I mean, it was the same stories I heard in the saloons about, you know, people going through windows and car wrecks and everything. But they all had happy endings. In the saloon, they had terrible endings. The guy was still picking glass out of his head. The cops were taking him out in handcuffs. These guys had happy endings to their story. They were there. So I signed on with the Body Snatchers. But as I said, I didn't ask for help. I heard it all, but I was going to do it myself. And there came a 6 years in and out of AA, and it got worse and worse and worse. I had numerous jobs, some related to advertising, some had nothing. I was a bartender. I was an iron worker. I once found my dream job. It was one of those, I think it was 1980. I took the census, and the census has what you call enumerators, and enumerators go to people, the bad people that don't return their forms, and they quiz them and, you know, they ask them everything. I loved that job. I sat in a saloon and I made up lives for people. And I got $15 for a life. I'd look at a name, I'd say, oh, he's a Jewish lawyer. Good. That's right. This guy, I gave him an income, everything. When I got sober, it dawned on me that the government plans on this data. So if things are a little tipsy, alcoholic, blame it on the data I sent in. Anyway, get quickly towards the end here. I moved around a lot. I lived in Long Beach. I lived, the old neighborhood turned Hispanic to a certain extent. The Irish moved away anyway, but there was still a hardcore there, including my mother. I lived in Bronxville. I lived all over the place. I ended up down here on 80th Street with some gal. I used to be one of those guys that would play the wounded bird and look for women to take care of them. And when the bird got better, I flew off, usually with your money, maybe your heart, but I always flew off with the money. Anyway, with this one woman I'm living with this time, she asked me to deposit a check for her in the bank. And she was going on a business trip. So I took the check. And again, I always started out to do the right thing till I had the first cocktail. And I said, Jesus, look at the size of this check. And I said, I'm going to invest this wisely at OTB for her. And that was the one of the stories of my life. The other story of my life, I always remember, when I was in the Army, at around 11 o'clock at night, we were in there with some rebels, and they used to turn on this station in Wheeling, West Virginia, WWL. It was a 50,000-watt clear channel, and bang out all over the world, and it played cowboy music, as they called it at the time, country and western. And my bunk buddy Neil used to say, here comes the misery hour. You know, it was always, my father ran off with my wife or something, you know. But the one I loved, I just dug that song, it was, cigarettes and whiskey and wild, wild women, they'll drive you crazy, they'll drive you insane. And I love that. Another song I loved in drinking was by Louis Jordan and his Timpani Five. I thought this was probably one of the great philosophies. What's the use of getting sober if you're going to get drunk again? I take this lady's check. I go to OTB. It's the story of my life. Fast women, slow horses. And I know she's coming back, and I know I'm going to be on the road again. So I get up in the morning, and before she wakes up and goes to the bank, and the numbers come up, you know, all zeros. And I'm sitting in a little joint called the Yorkville. The Yorkville was a Hungarian joint that had The only American song in a jukebox was Happy Birthday. Everything else was in Hungarian. I loved it. I don't know a word of Hungarian. And it had a regular 8 o'clock in the morning, look in the mirror and plan their life crowd. And I was part of it. Or read the daily news and then plan your life. And while I'm sitting there saying, well, I'm going to be on the road with my shopping bag again when she finds out, a young lady comes in. And the bartender, whose name was Lulu, which gives you an idea what kind of joint it was. Lulu says, hey, Cammy, I'm proud of you. I hear you don't drink anymore. And a couple of guys says, she's no fun no more. And she said, yeah, I don't drink. And he said, what'd you do? You don't drink. She said, I went to AA. Now, I had my ear on the conversation, as you always do, looking to see if you can, maybe somebody will buy you a drink. So I said, well, I went to AA and it don't work. And she said, why didn't you try it again? And of course, I had always heard over that 6 years, you can always come back. So I said, well, I don't know where their meeting is. She's newly sober. Out comes the meeting book, a magic marker. She's circling on. Now, the first meeting was on 79th Street. She's offering to walk me down there and there. I said, no, I'll make it. I'll go down. So I planned to go to the 12:30 meeting at the 79th Street workshop. But first, I'm going across the street to the Wicked Wolf. I walk into the Wicked Wolf. It's about 11:45. The bartender's cutting his lemons, getting ready for the lunchtime crowd. I says to him, you'll never guess what I'm doing today. He looks up at me and he says, no, Eddie, what are you doing today? I said, I'm going to AA. And he says, you want to pay your tab? More prophetic. What a resentment I had, but more prophetic words. Anyway, I went down to the 12:30 meeting. It was over the Hungarian workshop. No, the Hungarian Literary Society. We were the 79th Street Workshop, Hungarian Literary. Quick aside, I was once the treasurer of the workshop, and I had to go down to the Hungarian Literary Society to pay our rent. There wasn't a book in the Hungarian Literary Society. There was card tables, bottles of beer. No books in the Hungarian Literary Society. I don't know if they've changed, but anyway. So I went to that first meeting. I heard the same stories, and I said, I'm going to give this a shot again. I come out of there at 1:30. I walk east down. St. Monica's was open. This was before crack really hit, and you had to close church doors because they were stealing the stuff off the altar. But I went in, and again, I was brought up Irish, Roman, Catholic, and I prayed. And I said, God, help me. Just like I told you guys before, I asked for help. He was the first one I asked for help. And I went out of there, and I had a couple of more drinks, but I ended up at meeting on 86th Street and between Lex and Park. I can't remember it now. Regency, right. Thanks, Peg. And I didn't have another drink. And that was 25 going on 26 years ago. I mean, I don't know what happened, except I do know what happened. This time I asked for help. I went to meetings with the same fervor I chased a drink. I followed the instruction manual, which is the big book. You know, I think I could probably, you know, you go into Barnes & Noble and you see these computer books, Microsoft for Dummies. I could have written an AA book for dummies. You know, and dummy, do what they tell you. That's all you can do. I got a sponsor miles away from me, a guy from Kansas, a chemical engineer, and it was like finding a second father. I got active in the group. I did my steps. I sponsored. I have to give a shout out. Ron Black was one of my sponsees. So you got him now, kids. And slowly but surely, things got better. They didn't get great. I'm 71 years old. I'm still working selling mattresses, okay? And I love selling my mattresses. I love going to work. I got married in the program. I told you my son got sober. Let me backtrack just for a second because it's not all laughs and games. The two important people in my life were my mother and father as an only child. I got a call one time. My father was dying. My mother said, please be down to the hospital tonight. And I said, Ma, I'll be there. I went to the saloon beforehand. Again, I started off with good intentions. I had a drink. I told my bartender my father was dying. He bought me a drink. The guy next to me had lost his father. I bought him a drink. I woke up the next morning. my ex-father-in-law, who I was still friends with, was banging on the door. My father had died that night, and I wasn't there. My mother was the ace in the hole. I always went to my mother. You know, I made more money in a week than she made in a year, and still it went again over the mahogany, chasing horses, I know, wherever it went. Mom was always there. I don't know why you're always so broke, you know, but you know, I'll give it to you next week. Anyway, in the end, my mother was failing. She was still in the same neighborhood. I used to go because she'd get a pension check and a Social Security check. I told you the neighborhood was sort of falling apart. I used to break into the mailbox and steal her checks. And then I'd go up and have a cup of tea with her, and she'd say, you know, Eddie, they broke into the mailbox last week. I said, Ma, you got to move out of this neighborhood. It's going bad. I felt terrible. My mother died. I then had the Social Security and the pension check sent to me under the, you know, we can rationalize anything. My mother would have wanted me to have this money. I needed the money to drink and stay alive. And then I would go into an old saloon. You know, the neighborhood never totally changes. There's some people you have to blast out there, and it's still a smattering of Irish saloons. And I'd say, my mom's not feeling good. She's been dead 2 years now. Could you please cash your check? You know, and the guy's, I haven't seen her at Mass lately. Yeah, just cash the check, pal. I've always loved animals. Through my last 10 years or so of drinking, I had a German shepherd. His name was Seamus. Seamus and I were inseparable. We'd go everywhere together. I met a lady. She had a house in Bronxville, but she had two daughters, and she just said, move in with me. She loved to drink, but she said, I'm scared with my kids, with the dog. I took Seamus and I put him to sleep because I had to drink. And I don't carry that stuff, but I like to remember it because it's, you know, you laugh at the fun and games. But the pain was always there. Everything was always dark and gloomy. You know, in Dante's Inferno, there's a sign over hell, and it says, all ye who enter here abandon hope. And that's what alcoholism was for me. I never thought of orphaning myself, but I had lost all hope, and I just plodded through. But when I came to AA, it was like going to church, you know, you get the holy water bottle and you bless yourself, holy water fountain. AA, it's not there, but there's like a font at the door and you get a grasp of hope. It could be big, could be little, but it's there that, hey, maybe I got a shot. And I did get a shot. And so here I am today. One of the greatest things that AA gave me, there was a great song by Gershwin. I won't sing it because you'll encourage me to go on to American Idol. So I'll just recite the lyrics. And it's, there's someone I'm longing to see. I'm hoping that someone will be someone to watch over me. And that's what I got when I came here. I've got a God that watches over me, and I've got a wonderful group of people that watch over me. I don't think I'm going to go to the end of my full 30 minutes. I hope I haven't deprived you. But I love you all, and God bless you all. Thank you.